This is Farms Food Future, a podcast that's good for you, good for the planet, and good for farmers. Brought to you by the International Fund for Agricultural Development. I'm Brian Thompson. This month is when we celebrate World Environment Day. And to help you do that, we've been out and about checking the environmental credentials from Asia to Africa and over to South America. First, we'll be checking in with IFAD's Associate Vice President, Marie Hager, about how IFAD is balancing development and the environment when it comes to farming. Also, we'll be hearing about some interesting innovations from IFAD's Director for Environment and Climate, Joe Puri. And then, with Africa Climate Week coming up, we've more innovative tales of climate risk assessment from East and Southern Africa from Linda Odhiambo in Nairobi. And we have a news report on nature-based solutions and farming. That story from Freddie Harvey-Williams. Our intrepid reporter Kayla Carvalho will be talking to Kekashan Basu, a UN human rights champion, about how the environment inspired her. And she'll also be checking in on changes to environmental policies in Afghanistan, plus organic farming in China, and a new group called Chefs for the Planet, find out who they are, and much more. It's not just World Environment Day this month, but it's also International Day of Family Remittances, a vital source of funding for people living in rural communities in the developing world. We'll have more on that. Don't forget, we want to hear from you. What do you think about our stories, and who do you want us to be talking to? So please get in touch with me at podcasts@ifad.org. And don't forget to subscribe to this podcast via your favourite podcast platform, and please rate us. This is Farms Food Future, and this year's World Environment Day is being hosted by Pakistan. And it'll be on the theme of ecosystem restoration, focusing on resetting our relationship with nature. Marie Hager is Associate Vice President at IFAD. I asked her how important it is for agriculture to take the environment into account when looking to build resilience.
This year, the UN is pleased to launch the UN Decade on Ecosystem Restoration on this very important day for the world and also for agriculture. Smallholder farmers, in particular in rural areas, bear the brunt of climate change and the degradation of natural resources. Extreme weather events such as droughts, storms, and floods put tremendous pressure on the ecosystems that farmers depend on. In fact, projections show that if current trends continue, crop yields will reduce by 8% due to climate change by 2050. This means that we need to increase food production by 14% to keep pace with demand, population growth, etc. So agriculture and smallholder farmers are pivotal in the solution to doing this. And with ecosystems degrading, with soil degrading, it's just going to be much, much more difficult. Some of IFAD's most important work is agriculture and natural resource management. We empower smallholder farmers to increase their productivity and adapt to climate change. In doing this, IFAD promotes agricultural growth that is environmentally sustainable, integrated into ecosystems, and respects the rights and role of the farmers that depend on it for their livelihoods. Our work helps farmers and fishers become more resilient to the impact of climate change and more able to manage natural resources more sustainably and efficiently. By making sure agriculture practices are resilient, we therefore increase not only the resilience of our world's ecosystem, but also the resilience of the people living on our world's almost 500 million small-scale farms.
Turning to the latest on COVID and rural communities, how's that going in terms of impact in developing countries now?
I think we unfortunately have to say that the pandemic has an increasingly significant impact in developing countries, despite progress made in vaccines and vaccinations. This impact is hardest felt in areas where poverty and hunger are most prevalent and access to health services is most limited. It's the same old story. The poorest are always the hardest hit in any crisis, and that also goes for COVID. The number of people who have fallen into extreme poverty due to COVID-19 is projected to reach between 110 and 150 million people this year. And people in lower income countries may have to wait for up to four years to receive a vaccine. And as if that is not enough, given their location and accessibility, the rural poor are likely to be at the back of this queue. We've never seen anything like this.
How is IFAD's ongoing work rolling out in relation to all of this?
IFAD did a lot of things very early in the process of COVID taking the grip. We established, for example, the Rural Poor Stimulus Facility. And our work through the Rural Poor Stimulus Facility continues to be in high demand. And I am pleased also to say, to have a tangible impact for our beneficiaries in the most hard to reach areas. As of mid-April, approximately $45 million US dollars have been approved under this facility. This is expected to reach approximately 3.2 million beneficiary households. By the close of the facility, we aim to have deployed all of the $93 million US dollars raised for the facility to provide COVID response. And that would support almost 8 million households. So I think it's fair to say that this is impressive, but it's just so much more that needs to be done.
Thanks to Marie Hager. Up next, we hear about innovative projects in the environmental field with Joe Puri. You're listening to Farms Food Future. I'm Brian Thompson. As Marie mentioned, this World Environment Day will see the launch of the UN Decade of Ecosystem Restoration. Ecosystem restoration can take many forms: growing trees, greening cities, rewilding gardens, changing diets, or cleaning up rivers and coasts. But is this the generation that can make peace with nature? Our reporter Kayla Carvalho asked IFAD's Director of Environment, Climate and Social Inclusion, Joe Puri, how IFAD is helping farmers make peace with nature while also improving their livelihoods.
Small-scale farmers are actually the group that IFAD is built around. That's the niche group that we focus on with all of our programs, with our program of work, with all of our technical work, with all of our advisory work, with all of our knowledge work. And this is important. This is important because I think we are the only agency, and I say that with humility, that recognizes that small-scale farmers produce more than 30% of the world's food supply. So the food that comes to our table. And yet they only get less than 2% of the overall climate finance flows in the world. And if you computed that as a percentage of overall development assistance, it would go into, you know, the decimal points with many zeros after the decimal. So what I'm trying to say is that IFAD, through its focused attention on small-scale farmers through a very concerted program on not just looking at building market institutions, value chains, government policy, but also looking at production systems, increasing efficiencies, or both on the demand side of how farmers get affected, trying to change that side, changing people's own nutrition patterns, but also on the supply side. So changing farmers' own production systems, both through increasing their efficiency as well as increasing their resilience, IFAD works very, very closely with farmers in rural areas across the world. We work in 80 countries.
The UN Decade of Ecosystem Restoration launched on World Environment Day this year. Are you optimistic that smallholder farmers in developing countries will be able to play their part in restoring the planet?
I think it's a little unjust to expect small-scale farmers who are very thinly spread and who are really fighting for their survival and for their livelihoods to get them to and to expect action from them, even though they are doing a lot. So, for example, in the Great Green World Corridor that we are planning in West Africa as well as East Africa, the focus is a lot on natural resource management, on changing production techniques, on restoring agroecological practices, and really working with farmers so that they can adopt these new practices and processes and restore a large part of these lands. They're doing their part. I want to turn the question to the agencies such as IFAD, such as many other multilateral agencies in the world, and get them to do their part in really turning the world around. I do think that as a multilateral agency, we have a disproportionate amount of responsibility for this, and we should take it on because it's the farmers that are putting food on our tables. So it's a challenge for international agencies such as IFAD. I think we are up to it, but it does require that everybody puts not just their energies, but also their money where their mouth is.
Why should smallholder farmers care if it wasn't them that caused the problems for the planet in the first place?
So unfortunately, we are living in an unjust world. They didn't cause the problem, but they will unfortunately bear a disproportionate amount of the impact of climate change, uncertainty, variability, and burden that is caused as a consequence. Resilience is essentially a measure of trying to understand not just how well we can anticipate changes in climate, as well as other changes in our environment, but it's also the ability to cope. And although farmers might be able to anticipate a lot of the changes that are occurring, especially because of their knowledge systems, unfortunately, they are far less likely and far less able than you and I to be able to cope with a lot of the variability, with the uncertainty that comes with it. In a previous position, when I was in South Korea, typhoons essentially racked through the entire country. Farmers and their production patterns were so badly hit that entire value chains were essentially destroyed, and which meant that a lot of farmers went without wages and without income for many days. It did not mean that I went without food, but it did mean that they went without income. So unfortunately, we are living in a world which is unjust, and so farmers should care. But caring does not mean that they have to take on the responsibility of action. I think they're doing their bit. We have to do ours.
Does the current situation, where we need to support production while still taking COVID-19 to account, make it harder to work in balance with nature and support ecosystems?
I think the current situation really underscores as to why we should work in sync with nature. A lot of the zoonotics transmission that is very much based on zoonotics and the transmission from animal systems to human systems is occurring primarily because we are threatening ecosystems. This is well known, and it is also well known that the frequency of such like pandemics is only going to increase if we are not careful. So as we think about how we want to design progress, now that we've had this rude shock to the world, I think it will be important for us to restructure and repurpose our own finance flows. It will be important for us to rethink how we want to grow. And it will be very, very important for multilateral agencies such as IFAD to take leadership in this space so that we can be responsible for the people who are putting food on our plates.
That was Joe Puri, Director of Environment, Climate and Social Inclusion at IFAD. Up next, innovation for the environment in agriculture in East and Southern Africa. This month also sees the UNFCCC Africa Climate Week. And we know that smallholder farmers and poor rural people bear the brunt of climate change and the degradation of natural resources. Extreme weather events such as droughts, storms and floods are putting pressure on the ecosystems that farmers depend on. Crop failures and livestock deaths are causing economic losses, and undermining the food security of rural people with ever greater frequency, especially in parts of sub-Saharan Africa. How can we empower the smallholder farmers to take charge of their own destiny? Our reporter, Linda Odhiambo, spoke to Paxina Chileshi, IFAD's regional climate and environment specialist, to find out how IFAD-supported projects in Malawi, Mozambique, and Rwanda are empowering farmers with the necessary skills and tools to undertake climate risk analysis and determine appropriate solutions for the challenges they face.
So, Linda, for the International Fund for Agriculture Development, we are supporting farmers in climate risk analysis in three main ways. Firstly, providing them with improved access to climate information. Secondly, we provide them with training to be able to use the climate information that they receive. And third, we are helping them in terms of providing resources, financial resources, for them to be able to invest in specific activities to improve their farming.
So with this support that you're providing, what kind of solutions are you seeing smallholder farmers adopt on based on the climate risk analysis they are undertaking?
What we have seen farmers use more of, for example, in Rwanda, where we have the climate resilient post-harvest and agribusiness support project that is focusing on reducing post-harvest losses, farmers are investing in renewable energy solutions. So, in a sense, solar-powered drying facilities, solar-powered processing facilities, so primary processing like washing, and of course in the storage, we also have cold storage that is solar-powered, but also biogas. And we are also seeing farmers use more rainwater harvesting systems, particularly in the drier areas of the country. In Malawi, where we have the Program for Rural Irrigation Development, and the irrigation systems will help farmers to be able to produce even in times of years of drought. But farmers also cultivate rain-fed areas. And here we have seen farmers use more conservation agriculture techniques, so minimum tillage. They ensure that there is crop cover to maintain moisture in the soil, and also use mixed cropping systems. In Mozambique, where we are focusing mainly in the drought-prone areas of the south, we have seen farmers adopt more drought-tolerant crops and also varieties of these crops, for example, cassava. We are also seeing farmers make use of solar-powered multi-purpose boreholes. So they use the water from the boreholes for livestock, but also for their agricultural production, and they're also using this for their domestic water use. We also have farmers that are making use of shade cloths for horticulture, and shade cloths are low-cost greenhouses. So a key component, a key consideration for the farmers is the cost of these technologies. And of course, the more affordable they are, the more sustainable they will be. So the farmers will be able to, are empowered to be able to use information, use their knowledge, but also adopt these low-cost type of technologies.
What has been the impact of all this?
The impact that we have seen so far, for example, in Rwanda, where we have, where we're targeting the reduction of post-harvest losses, we have seen a reduction of 60% in the losses. So what the losses that happen after the harvest, farmers are now able to use more of their harvest to bring about the benefits that they need. So this 60% reduction of post-harvest losses has been in maize, beans, and Irish potato as commodities that the smallholder, that the farmers depend on. In Mozambique, we have seen a 300% increase in yields, so tripling of the harvest over the same pieces of land that the farmers are cultivating, particularly for crops such as cassava, for cabbage, peppers, and green beans. Overall, this increased production will lead to the farmers being able to have that surplus, so food for their families, yes, food to feed their communities, but also the surplus to sell to the market. This will then result in increased incomes for the farmers, but also increased dietary diversity at the household level. And both of these, we know, will lead to improved livelihoods, but also improved well-being within our communities.
That was Paxina Chileshi, IFAD's climate change expert, speaking to our reporter Linda Odhiambo in Nairobi. For more information about our work on climate and the environment, visit our website www.ifad.org/climate. Coming up, a new report just in time for World Environment Day on nature-based solutions and farming. You're listening to Farms, Food, Future. We're now in the first year of the United Nations decade of ecosystem restoration, and in the years building up to it, nature-based solutions have garnered greater global attention. In the first of a new technical report series, IFAD will share experiences from their Adaptation for Smallholder Agriculture program. The publication includes lessons from IFAD projects in Sudan and Niger, and its release is set to coincide with the Global Landscapes Forum on Restoring Africa's Drylands, starting on the 2nd of June. Freddie Harvey-Williams has this report.
The nature-based solutions concept reinforces that people are not just the passive beneficiaries of ecosystem services and biodiversity. They can proactively protect, manage, and restore natural ecosystems and the services that they provide, which represents a significant contribution to addressing climate change and other major societal challenges. While nature-based solutions are not a silver bullet for combating climate change, they are an important tool in a one-planet approach to achieving the 2030 agenda. In 2020, the International Union for the Conservation of Nature released the first global standard for nature-based solutions. Nature-based solutions are diverse and can be geographically and culturally specific. Thus, more comprehensive research into successful operationalisation of nature-based solutions will help to increase global uptake, understanding and investment in nature-based solutions. With this in mind, IFAD are releasing a new report on nature-based solutions in the Adaptation for Smallholder Agriculture Programme, or ASAP, portfolio. The report analyses 7 case studies in agricultural systems in which nature-based solutions yield both direct and indirect benefits to local farmers, including climate change mitigation, climate adaptation, various ecosystem services, food security, and other social benefits. The report discusses lessons learned and the way ahead towards stronger operationalization of nature-based solutions. Success of nature-based solutions in ASAP projects can be highly attributed to strong community participation and a bottom-up approach. The next phase of ASAP, ASAP Plus, which launched this year, will continue to be a vehicle for trialing and upscaling nature-based solutions, building on experience and lessons learned from ASAP 1, and providing more evidence for the importance of NBS to governments and donors.
That was Freddie Harvey-Williams reporting, and that report can be found from 2nd of June on ifad.org. Coming up, we hear from a young woman who is a champion for the environment. This is Farms, Food, Future, and I'm Brian Thompson. Everywhere in the world, the voices of young people are speaking about the environment and social issues. More than speaking up, they're also creating their own organisations and projects to fight for the future they want. To talk more about these young leaders and their impact on the world, we spoke with Kekashan Basu, a United Nations human rights champion. Kekashan has been an environmental activist since she was 8 years old and also fights for gender equality. She talked to us about what led her to that path and what she's been doing ever since.
My bubble burst when I was 7, when I saw the image of a dead bird with its stomach full of plastic And I could not stop thinking about the pain the bird must have gone through as it died and choked on that plastic. And it was also around that time that I attended a lecture by environmentalist Robert Swan, whose words, "The greatest threat to our planet is the belief that someone else will save it," really resonated with me. And that is what inspired me to plant my first tree on my 8th birthday as the symbolic start to my journey. And my birthday is also 5th June, World Environment Day. So I thought that I was preordained to become an eco warrior. So that is what inspired me to start my sustainability journey. And there's been no looking back since then.
You founded the Green Hope Foundation, a youth organization, in 2012. How did it come to be, and what are its main goals?
When I was 12 years old, I was at Rio +20, which, as you know, was the largest sustainable development conference of the time. And out of the 50,000 delegates there, I was one of the only 5 under the age of 18. And I really didn't like that, because we as children and young people deserve to have that seat at the table where we were talking about our present and future. So on my return home, I founded Green Hope Foundation so that I could provide children and young people with a platform to learn about sustainability challenges and then learn how to take actions to mitigate these problems. So currently we work in 25 countries with over 140,000 young people. And just you asked about our main goals. In 2015, when the SDGs were adopted, I was 15 and the youngest out of the 193 young people each selected to represent each UN member state at the adoption ceremony. And that is why the SDGs were really, really close to my heart. And what we realized was that our work was exactly what the SDGs mandated. So all we had to do now in 2015 was just link the goals. So now Green Hope Foundation works on leaving no one behind and ensuring a life of dignity for all, as mandated by the SDGs, and really localizing all of these goals, ensuring that we recognize their interconnections and also recognize how important it is to see the unique local challenges that each country or region faces. So yeah, we work on literally all aspects of sustainable development.
This March, you spoke at our IFAD International Women's Day event. Can you tell us more about your fight for women's rights and why it's important that we have a conversation about gender equality?
Absolutely. You know, women's rights are not separate from any of the other issues our world is facing. In fact, women are the ones affected most by climate change and disasters, war, strife, and literally every other problem that is out there. So in my work, when, for example, in the Syrian refugee camp where we have worked, in our workshops, there was a 13-year-old girl with her carrying her own baby in her arms. In Bangladesh, one of our most active participants, especially during this pandemic, she too is 13. As soon as she reached puberty, she conceived and she has a son now. But the point is that these girls are the ones who are left behind when it comes to education. None of them have education, but if they do have the opportunity, it's the boys that go to school. And just another example, in Suriname, we had conducted a workshop for one of the schools over there. And when it came out, there was a girl carrying, she was, I think, 8, if I'm not mistaken, and carrying a baby in her arms. And then when my colleague asked in their local language why she was standing out there and looking so longingly inside the school window, she said that her mother had to go to work. And that is why she was the one who had to take care of her baby brother, whereas her older brother was allowed to go to school. But the longing in her eyes to get that education, to be there in that classroom, that is what like really tugged at my heartstrings. And, you know, these are just some of the examples that I have seen all around the world of just women being left behind, and especially women and girls being left behind in sustainability. So just to go back to the point of the SDGs as well, when I was talking about the interconnections, when we talk about women's rights and Goal 5 gender equality, if we don't also address clean water and sanitation, her access to that, or education, or, you know, in peace building and how the lack of peace affects women and girls, then, you know, we are not going to be able to achieve a sustainable world. So yeah, that is why my fight for women's rights has been so deeply interconnected in all that I do, because of the fact that women and girls are so disproportionately affected by literally all of our world's challenges.
Tekashan finished by advising people to recognize that there are local challenges and local solutions. According to her, there's no one-size-fits-all solution, especially when it comes to developing nations, and the Western world should be aware of that if it wants to bring real results. Thanks to Kekashan for speaking to our reporter Kayla. Next, we'll be talking about Afghanistan, where environmental policy reform is taking place. This is Farms Food Future. To change environmental policy, it's vital to take care of resource management, including how to better make use of water resources in a place that's been so affected by climate change. One of the main projects to support the new regulations is the Argandab Integrated Water Resource Development Project, supported by IFAD. With evidence-based policies, the plan is to increase the capacity of the Dala Dam and in this way increase access to water and irrigation. Our reporter, Kayla Carvalho, interviewed Chandra Samektko, who told us more about the project, the impacts it can have on the environment and population, and how they plan to direct the increased capacity of the dam.
We plan to use it for the irrigation and also for the water supply to Kandahar city and also for electricity generation. So there are multi-purpose dam. And to accommodate that, particularly IFAD in ADB looking at the irrigation. And in irrigation, because of it's a multi-user of the water, then there is also a potential conflict in the future. Probably it will not be so obvious at the moment, but within the project, we're not only supporting the infrastructures, institutional development, but we also increase the capacity of the technical water officer in the countries and also support on the policy reform. What we do that we want to establish a new vehicle, this kind of entity, to operate the dams and also to make sure that the operation, the water allocation can be sustainable and continuously plan well together with the farmers, water user associations, and of course, considering to the other stakeholders, because this also related to the water supply to the cities and also for the electricity generation plan.
How did the Argandab Integrated Water Resources Development Project improve management and use of water resources? Like, what difference did it make?
Okay, first, probably let's bring the context of Afghanistan, because Afghanistan is impacted severely from the climate change. There's so many drought come in regularly. And this also impacted the productivity of the smallholder farmers. When the water not become available, of course, it's impacted on the plants and their production. So this is where the IFAD come in, intervention, introduction of the irrigation infrastructures. We rehabilitate the existing one, but to make sure that the water available, then we also working on the upstream. It means that we make sure that the water available all the year through the dams. And the current one, actually, there is already existing dam, but not sufficient to demand even now and also in the future. That's why we increase the dam and also improve in the capacity of the water reservoir. It's mean that the more water become available. And by putting irrigation infrastructures, it means that we increase and modernize the water, like say delivery from the dam to the field. And it increased the efficiency because without the modernization and rehabilitation of the water losses will be so much. And then with limited resources, then it will become an issue.
What were some of the other results achieved by the project?
So the project just has been approved in December 2019. So it's just on the starting points. And the project now just established project management offices in three different ministries, in the water authorities, in Ministry of Rural Rehabilitation and Development, and also Ministry of Agriculture, Irrigation and Livestock. So there are three different implementing agencies where they established project management offices. And also since the project just started in 2020, early 2020, and the COVID-19 hit. So it's impacted the project quite significant because many activities was on hold. I think only several community contracting that we work with the community on the irrigation rehabilitation on the downstream still ongoing. But hopefully, starting this year on the coming months, then the project can picking up the performance and then make a good progress to catching up and back on track to meet our development objectives.
Thank you, Kandra, for speaking to us. Next up, we'll be talking about Chefs for the Planet, an international community of chefs which promotes healthy eating, climate action, and sustainability. You're listening to Farms Food Future. Chefs for the Planet. It's all about healthy eating, climate action, and sustainability. For that, our reporter Kayla Carvalho interviewed Anne Lamour, one of the founders of the organization. Lamour started by telling us what the main goals of the project are.
The goals is really to raise awareness and educate as many people as possible. So the larger public is our target, about what it means to eat healthily and in a way which does not destroy our health, does not destroy our resources, protect the biodiversity and nature, and also try to reduce our carbon footprint so as to contribute to lesser global warming.
Can you tell us more about how you help chefs and cooks be more sustainable in their actions?
Yeah, so we're really an influential kind of influencers, network. So what we do is among our chefs, which are part of our community, and we are a young initiative. We started last June, in June 2020, and we have about 100 international chefs in our network to date, and the community is fast growing. As I said, our target is a larger public, but also we want to inspire chefs among them to show as many of them that other chefs are very much engaged on different aspects of sustainability. So I mentioned, for instance, sourcing of products. You know, this is very important. Or the kind of ingredients that you propose in your restaurant. So the kind of products or the recipes that you produce. Or all the attention that you pay to not wasting food or not wasting water or electricity, energy savings, or if you pay particular attention, for instance, also to animal welfare and the way, you know, you're careful with meat and fish. You know, for instance, there are many species of fish which are disappearing, and paying attention to not over-exploiting certain fish as opposed to others. So it's kind of, you know, helping the chefs through engaged chefs, helping other chefs to improve their awareness and the way they cook and what they propose to their customers in a way which is much more engaged and much more respectful of the environment and the nature, and reduce the carbon footprint of our plate.
What's in the future for Chefs for the Planet to promote sustainable food and gastronomy for all?
What we're trying to do is different things. First, we're participating more and more in events with our chefs and as an organization. So debate, conferences, obviously there are many of them are digital at the moment, but in partnership with others, like we have a partnership with UNESCO, and we are featuring some of the chefs of our network who can tell firsthand what they're doing in their kitchen to reduce, you know, global warming, etc. This is one area where we're focusing a lot. The second, as I said, we really want to educate and sense and raise awareness among as many people as possible, including the youth and children as well. So we're going to engage more and more in social media campaigns with our chefs to do some videos and propose very simple recipes, for instance. So this is another area. We're also gearing up for the UN Food Systems Summit, which hopefully will take place in the fall on the margins of the General Assembly. And there again, we hope that with our chefs and other networks of chefs, we will be able to really showcase that we can cook differently in a way which is not only good also for health and the planet, but which is yummy and super tasty, because food is also, and perhaps even more importantly, about pleasure and taste. So yes, engaging in communication and events and more partnerships. This is our focus for 2021. And it's also a way for us to show solidarity with chefs and restaurants, which are so impacted by the current pandemics.
That was Anne Lamore from Chefs for the Planet. You can also find out more about IFAD's own chef initiative, Recipes for Change, at www.ifad.org/recipes-for-change. And you can find more podcasts at www.ifad.org/podcasts. In episode 19, we talked about the mental health crisis that's hit farmers under COVID. In episode 18, we heard from the people at the Earthshot Prize. And in episode 17, we celebrated International Women's Day. All that and lots more in Farm's Food Future. Coming up, we talk organic farming in China. This is Farm's Food Future. In 2010, organic farmers in Beijing were having a difficult time selling their products. But then came along the Beijing Farmers Market. The market invites consumers to meet organic farmers and understand where their food comes from. It moves from place to place since it's not government supported, but the participants use the constant relocation as an opportunity to find new customers each time, letting more people know about their existence. Our reporter, Kayla Carvalho, talked to Chang Tenwu Lu, one of the founding members of the market. She told her more about the positive impact the markets had supporting small farmers in China.
At first, we only work with small organic producers in Beijing. But as we grow, we became kind of a benchmark of the China's food movement in general. So lots of farmers outside Beijing would also come to us, ask us if they can participate or if they can't be present in person, if we can sell their products or help them to market their products to consumers, not only in Beijing, but to a nationwide consumer. We have been supporting small farmers, organic farmers in China in two ways. One is through sales. We help them to reach more consumers, market their products at an organic price, at a fair price that they can continue to grow in an organic way and support their family. But the second support comes from more of advocacy. That is to say, we help all the small organic producers in China to educate consumers why it is important to support your local organic farmer and how they make a special contribution to our environment. And most of these farmers, in addition to just organic farming, sustainable farming, they do lots of other things such as preserve traditional seeds, support a local economy, children's care, education, looking after the elderly. So they do lots of things in their rural community, which is also important. And we share those stories with the public so that the public have a better understanding of what rural life is like and how healthy food is produced and why by buying directly from these farmers, they can make a contribution to the rural development.
Nowadays, more and more people search for sustainable alternatives when buying food. What are some of the Beijing Farmers Market's efforts to be more sustainable?
We approach food in a very environmental friendly way. We're very cautious about the carbon emission from food production and also from trade and sales, and also how we use food and how we deal with waste. So we try to approach this issue from every aspect, from production to consumption. Let's start from production. For our farmers, we ask them to farm in an organic way, which means they don't use any chemicals. And it's better for the soil, it's better for the plant. And many of our farmers only use resources locally. So it also reduces lots of transportation emission, and they use less energy to produce food. From consumption side, we also, first, we have a shorter food mileage. We encourage local consumption as local as they can. And also we ask farmers to have less package so that we don't use lots of plastics at the farmer's market. And most of the package should be reusable or they can be recycled. So we don't produce lots of waste at the farmer's market. We also have a small program to encourage kitchen waste composting. We teach people, consumers, how to compost at home. Of course, they can take it to the farmer's market and ask the farmers to take it back to the farm. So we have a more circular management of all the nutrients from food and agriculture. And we do lots of education campaign in the past 10 years to educate both the producers and consumers about the crisis we face and how, as individuals, we can make some small change. And maybe all these collective small changes can make a bigger change.
What are some of the challenges faced by the small farmers participating in the market?
I think the farmers we work with, the small, sometimes indigenous, independent organic farmers, they make the most contribution to our food safety, food security, and also they produce and they sell in a most environmental friendly way. But they face lots of challenges and the pressure or competition, unfair competition from big corporate farms and also from big food agribusiness. So in general, I think for a more climate friendly food system, these small organic producers make the biggest contribution, but they have the least policy and social support. And I don't think most of the public and the government understand that. That's why we don't see lots of strong policies to support these producers. And we hope to see change in that regard.
That was Chang Tiun Lu of the Beijing Farmers Market. Coming up, we talk remittances and the importance of sending money home to rural communities. This is Farms Food Future, and I'm Brian Thompson. The International Day of Family Remittances is observed on the 16th of June. It recognises the contribution of over 200 million migrant workers to improve the lives of their 800 million family members back home. This money allows families in developing countries to put food on the table, pay the bills, send kids to school. At least one quarter is saved or invested. I asked more from IFAD's Pedro de Vasconcelos about the theme of this year's International Day of Family Remittances.
Each year in the campaign, in partnership with member states and other international organizations, is to really promote certain aspects. This year, particularly in light of the crisis and what we've seen all through to 2020, was to highlight once more the aspects of towards recovery and resilience of remittance families. They have demonstrated this, but this year we want to promote these two aspects and ways to achieve it. And the ways to achieve it, Brian, are very simple, is to link remittances with financial inclusion and as well promote digitalization. These are the two main topics that we would like to make member states more aware of, as well as private sector entities, to provide more linkages between remittances and financial inclusion through, of course, digitalization as well. And if I might just add one more point in this, is why these two topics of financial inclusion? Because the majority of families receiving these flows receive it in cash, and not through a financial institution or an institution that could link these with savings, credit, insurance, and why not pensions? And this is where the real development impact is. Remittances can bring millions into the financial sector and can bring millions again into the new digital environment. And that can facilitate and address many of the reasons that, interesting enough, are the ones that cause a lot of migration that in turn created remittances.
You touched upon there how COVID has affected things. So can you go a little bit more into that and tell me how it's affected the flow of income?
Through every crisis that we have monitored in regards to remittances since 2000, be it a security one, an economic one, a migration one, one thing that was absolutely consistent over the years is the resilience of migrants and their families. Migrants will find a way to send remittances back home, not just because, again, it is for, this is one of the best elements to showcase that it's not just for consumption, but on the contrary, to achieve their daily needs. These funds are necessary to the lives of their families back home. So migrants will go the extra miles if needed to send these flows. And this is what the crisis has shown. There was a lot of fear at the beginning that given the lockdowns, many migrants were not able to send money. And we started identifying a drop on remittances. But interestingly enough, as more data came in, we realized that in some cases, actually, two things. More remittances were going for some countries, and migrants were using new channels, which is a big novelty because normally migrants will tend to stick to the means of that they have selected in the past to send remittances, and it's very difficult to change their minds. This has changed. Provided the lockdowns, the fact that migrants could not go outside to a money transfer company and put cash on the counter that will then put cash in the hands of their families, they opted and moved towards our digital means. So that has been dramatic and in a positive way, that change towards digitalization. But the second, as I said, is this: all the prognostics regarding the big decline on remittances were not as dramatic. There's been some decline. There's been communities that have been affected by the fact that migrants that were not working were not able to be able to send some of their savings, and that had a dramatic impact back home. But for the rest, we've seen that they maintain this aid back to their families back home, and in some cases increased. We saw, if I might add, one last main switch or change we've seen is also that a lot of the remittances that were going informally, meaning you give it to a friend that then travels and give it to your family, that and therefore was not really tracked. Well, that type of sending informal has significantly decreased, obviously, because people could not travel. So that has been also another positive impact on the crisis, that more of these flows that were unaccounted for because they were sent in a formal, informal way are now sent formal. And this also, we believe, accounts for this increase of remittances. So once more, I think it's we need to be very humble for this big lesson from 1 billion people supporting their families back home. They don't need publicity. They don't care if people know or not. Actually, they prefer normally not to. But it is a big economic component, a socioeconomic component that a significant part of humanity does on an everyday basis. So this has been very eye-opening for in terms of the lessons from the crisis in response to remittances.
Thank you to IFAD's Pedro de Vasconcelos. More details on the International Day of Family Remittances on the IFAD website /IDFR. And that brings us to the end of this bumper edition celebrating World Environment Day of Farms, Food, Future. Thanks to our producer, Francesco Manetti, our reporters, Freddie Harvey-Williams, Kayla Carvalho and Linda Odiambo, and everyone else who's worked on this programme. But most of all, thanks to you for listening to this episode of Farms, Food, Future, brought to you by the International Fund for Agricultural Development. You can find out more about any of these stories at www.ifad.org/podcasts. Remember, we want to hear from you. What do you think about our stories and the issues discussed? And who do you want us to be talking to? So please get in touch with me at podcasts@ifad.org. Send us your voice or text messages to that address, and we'll be happy to play you out in the next show. Also, don't forget to subscribe to this podcast via your favourite podcast platform, and please rate us. I'll be back at the end of June with more news fresh from the farm. We'll be talking all about the UN's food system pre-summit. And once again, we'll be trying to be good for you, good for the planet, and good for the farmers. Until then, from me, Brian Thompson, and the team here at IFAD, thanks for listening.